So I'm going to try and make it this slightly more relevant for the people that are here, all six of us. And it's the end of the day. And I understand most of you are probably not disability researchers, so I'll try to draw the links between disability and other forms of long-term care. In Australia... So this is presenting research that was conducted over the last 2 years on looking at the ways that we can evaluate and research around the effectiveness of the new personalisation programs that are coming into Australia in disability care. But this is also having a direct effect on aged care, of course, because those two parts of the social service system are highly related. So I'll try and bring some of those links together for you today. I'm one of a large research team that was involved in this research. So I'll start by talking about the changes in long-term care and particularly disability care in Australia at the moment. Talk about our research framework and methods and the effectiveness in terms of what happened for participants and their family members, and then talk about what that means in terms of the effectiveness of the program and policy implications. So Australia at the moment is going through an enormous change in the way that we provide social care for people with disability, and we expect that this will have a flow-on effect for aged care. It's called the National Disability Insurance Scheme, NDIS, and that's a social insurance system which is being touted in Australia as the biggest change since when we introduced Medicare, that is fully free public health and primary care in the 1980s. The reason that it's given that such a large rap in terms of that this is the next best thing is that the amount of social care dollars now available in disability has doubled, so it's moved from $6 to $12 billion per annum. And it's moved to an entitlement system. So it's anticipated that if you need disability support, you will get disability support. It's a very large claim. We don't know if it will happen, but that's what's anticipated. It's still on the basis of assessment and allocation of an individual package, and then you can decide whether you want to manage it yourselves, give it to an intermediary to manage, or through a service provider. The small programs like this that I'm going to talk about today that have already been implemented follow similar choices as we've seen in Europe over the last 30 years. So probably on average about 10 to 20% of people choose to manage it themselves or have their family members manage it with them. Most people still go to a service provider to have their support supplied to them. It's estimated that probably about 10% of disabled people will receive their support through this scheme when it's fully implemented. And, of course, it will be supplemented by other mainstream and informal support. So the big questions in terms of other long-term care and health is how does this reasonably well-funded but still assessed system butt up against a fully public health system and then also butt up against the other parts of the home care system. So, of course, a lot of potential for cost shifting and risks around that. The closest comparison is the Accident Compensation Commission in New Zealand, which positions accidents as virtually anything, so medical, physical, or some age-related change to your body. So that's the broader context in which this piece of research was done, where we were looking at programs where there had already been some level of personalisation introduced in disability housing support, and we were comparing various forms of individual packages, drop-in support, group housing and others. So you can see similar options to aged care, and that's why it's having a flow-on impact for aged care in Australia. I don't want you to look at the detail, but what we were interested in, because we are in a time of enormous change in Australia, we wanted to make sure that we had a program logic that could also apply to other forms of disability and aged care support. So particularly looking at the characteristics of the people that need support, the characteristics of the support so that it was following good practice in terms of person-centred support, that housing support was seen both as where someone lives and the support that they receive when they get there, and most importantly that we're actually focusing on why the support is being provided in terms of looking at a human rights framework in terms of outcomes for people. I think a lot of our focus, unfortunately, in research in disability and long-term care is very much around, well, what do we do rather than why do we do it? And I think that if we spend a bit more time thinking about the why, then some of the options that flow out of that are quite different. Okay, so just to give you a bit of a flavour of what people were saying in relation to having access to this sort of disability support, people were pleased. You know, they were getting the support, type of support that they needed, and the people pleased were the people themselves, their family members and their workers. So if I can give you an example, a person with disability who received drop-in support, so that's when somebody's coming into their home, she said, "When I first opened up the door, I knew that this was it. It was freedom." So she'd been able to move out from her family home. "These days I've got a smile on my face. I've got my own food. I can come and go as I please. I'm just loving it." So it had given her now the opportunity to experience her own autonomy. Similarly, a family member of someone who had received an individual package, she's beginning to forge new links, particularly gaining confidence, shopping for herself and finding regular places, for example, cafes where she's becoming known. So actually for the first time then in her life, being able to exercise independence and some real expression of choice there. And third, of course, the other side of it, the support workers. In this case, it was one again in a drop-in support. "My ability to develop and implement skills training has increased immensely, as have my observation skills." So she's comparing this to when she was providing support in a group. "Being able to meet and look at the big picture, working alongside the participants and their family, has allowed me to provide the training required to both suit the individual and the family environment." Okay, so we wanted to unpack those stories to say, well, it sounds good, everybody's happy, but is it effective? And particularly, is it a good use of the funds available? And so we did a typical evaluation looking at effectiveness in terms of did the housing support provide the intended services and changed outcomes for the people? Was it appropriate in terms of did it reach the right target group and particularly who missed out? And then thirdly, were the options implemented as planned? They weren't. So how did they change? Why did they change? And did those change actually maximise the effectiveness and respond to what was needed in other parts of the system? We used typical mixed methods in terms of administrative data, qualitative data, case studies, a lot of triangulation between all of the different stakeholder groups. Oops. And it was quite a large evaluation because it was across so many different options, and particularly because we could take advantage of the program data. Okay, so in the remaining time, I'll just concentrate on the findings around effectiveness. And this is the question around did they actually receive the type of services and change outcomes that were intended? as you can see from the quotes that I gave earlier on, yes, most people did achieve some outcomes, particularly around self-determination. But what was more disturbing was that the hard things, and in fact the meaningful things around social relationships, social participation, still weren't being addressed as we would expect in this sort of very flexible options. And the good outcomes really depended on the capacity and responsiveness of not only the formal support but the informal support around the person. So you can see again, as you would expect, it still privileges those people who have either their own capacity or family and informal capacity around them. The second set of questions were around appropriateness, as did it reach the right people? And although these were intended as universal programs, the people who had greatest access to support were men and younger people, so women and older people were less likely to get access to the new exciting ways of receiving support. And whether it actually met their support needs depended very much on the quality of the provider and staff. It didn't really matter what program, because if the provider and staff were providing the support in the way that met those characteristics around person-centeredness, it didn't matter what the government called it in terms of the name. They were focusing on using the funding and the contact hours in terms of finding out what the person wanted and then working out within the constraints of the resources how to meet that. And the third set of findings was around integrity. So was it implemented and planned, responsive to gaps and maximising effectiveness? And this, I think in a lot of these sort of evaluations, this in a way is the most important part, because these are the hard questions. We know that change is very difficult to bring about. And so the facilitators that we identified were, as I've mentioned before, a lot of it depended on the capacity of the informal supporters, the support worker skills, and then the provider responsiveness. So their willingness to actually look at cultural change. The challenges to actually bringing about those sort of changes were in terms of availability of information and decision-making support in ways that were meaningful for these people. And their knowledge, particularly around what they might be able to do with money. And when you haven't ever been in a situation where you can make those choices before, it's very difficult to say, okay, well, now work out what you want, work out how you're going to spend it, and then go away and arrange it. And so it's a very fearful situation for people to be put in. The strengths of these sort of programs were that flexibility was offered if people could cope with it. And so where people did have good support around them in terms of informal support and the good attitudes of the workers, then they could identify what their preferences were and find the sort of, particularly the housing and the support that they needed within that. On the other hand, if there wasn't that sort of culture, if there wasn't a focus on what we recognise as good practice, good quality mechanisms, then nothing about the structure of the program was going to change that. Okay, so I'll move on to the final part, which is talking about implications. And there are three parts to the implication: the design of these sort of programs, how they're implemented, and then what that means for how organisations work together. Today we've heard a lot about integration. It's a perennial problem and it always will be. Life is complex, so of course service systems are complex. The first is around design, and one of the fundamental questions that came through this is information, that people found it very difficult to understand change in the system. So it doesn't matter how many government websites there are, or even how many government people there are trying to help you. People don't trust the government. They trust each other, and they trust people who have already done it. And they needed that level of information translated down to a level where their emotional reactions of, oh my God, what's the government trying to do to me, could be addressed by speaking with someone or hearing from the stories of people that about what was possible. As I've mentioned, having flexibility in what the money could be spent on and knowing that that flexibility was there was very important in the design. Knowing that there was enough money and that if your circumstances changed, that money was going to be able to be reviewed was important. One of the, as I mentioned at the beginning, because of the changes under the National Disability Insurance Scheme and the broader context of the UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disabilities, even over the time that we were evaluating these programs, there was a big change in terms of expectations about where it's appropriate to offer support for people and what sort of support is appropriate. We're very lucky in Australia that there has been a strong acceptance of a rights-based approach to disability support. In my research career in disability, I wouldn't have said that 5 years ago. Whereas now, when I'm working in the community or working with government, I cannot and do not need to at any stage say do anything other than have this in a rights framework. And that's not something that I see across into the aged care sector yet. So it's a very interesting way that that changes the way that we think about, okay, why are we doing this? What do these... What can people expect, and particularly the implications on entitlement? Historically, in disability and still in aged care, we have an expectation of group housing, and already we see that changing. Already within these programs, people are making choices not to have their support provided in a group setting, and I would predict that that would be also happening in the future more within the aged care sector. One of the big questions that is happening for government now on this last point is in the past, a lot of these initiatives and currently in the fight back on the fear of now I've got an individual package but my family member really needs to live with other people like themselves, is that individuals, particularly groups or private sector, are still continuing to prefer and build and demand capital spending on group-based care. And so there's some big questions for government, particularly given the context of the National Disability Insurance and the UN Convention, as to whether that's appropriate and whether the government needs to be involved or capitulate to that. And I think the final set of policy implications I want to spend a bit of time talking about is in terms of collaboration. I know that in this sort of work, in disability and similarly in other parts of my work, that there are two sets of questions. One is about where people live and helping people to make those choices and then have those choices available. But the second is for service providers to recognise what they're good at and where they need to collaborate with other people. I think a reasonable approach to integration and coordination is to actually recognise, and we're not trying to rationalise, it's not, life's too complicated for that, but we are expecting people to know where to go for help. And when I say people, the service providers, that they need to, in this case, be collaborating on the areas that they're not expertise, don't have their own expertise in, but could quite reasonably be expected to collaborate with other people who do have that expertise. That might be around employment or education, specialist and mainstream services, community development, advocacy, and then referral. So I work for the Social Policy Research Centre in Sydney, and we run a number of projects around these sort of topics. I'd be very interested to speak with anybody who would like to follow up on any of those issues that I've raised. All of our reports and publications are publicly available free. And I'm here in London until December. So if there's anyone in Europe who would like to have a more of an in-depth conversation, now's my chance. So normally I spend my time reading your material and not being able to talk to you. So I would love to be able to actually talk to you during this time. Thank you.
So we have time for questions. We can start the discussion right now.
I have a question. How do you plan to measure the outcomes of such a new implementation, such a new program?
So in the work that we did for this project, the way that we measured it was a combination of measuring through the program data, so the outcomes that are measured there, and also then speaking to people. Because these were people with disability, many of them did not have a... could not speak themselves, but we, because we work in research teams where people have expertise in alternative forms of communication, we designed outcomes measures that came from that program logic. That we could either do through a written form or a spoken form or through an observation form. We also then triangulated that data with talking with the significant people in their life, whether that's in a paid or informal capacity. And the we didn't use a validated outcomes measure because most of those validated measures do not include those people who are most marginalised. Instead, we developed the outcomes measure based on both the personal wellbeing index, because it has an intellectual disability version, and the new UN Convention on the Rights of Persons with Disability.
When you talked about the outcomes in the presentation, you sort of gave the impression of a kind of mixed outcomes, and then moved swiftly on. Could
yes.
you say a little bit more about how those were mixed, what the outcomes were?
Okay, so it's long and complicated,
yes.
But yes, so most people, their lives improved, and that's because for most people, they were receiving support that they didn't receive in the past. For most people, the support workers in their lives had some understanding about good quality support. And so they went through a person-centred approach. The measures that we were looking at were standard quality of life measures in terms of their well-being, their independence, their autonomy, and so on. But the areas where there was less change was around social connections and social relationships. And we think that that's probably because of those... that is a big cultural change for the workers. So those workers have in the past been expected to work within an isolated or at worst segregated setting where people with disability are meeting with each other or they're meeting with their family members, rather than having new meaningful relationships in the community. So that's an enormous cultural change to expect. And secondly, it's an enormous cultural change for the wider community to have the awareness, to have the expectation, and to have the willingness to include people with other life experiences into their setting. So big community development obligations as well as worker changes. And that's why I emphasised what I think is very important around that collaboration, because an individual support worker can't do all of that. And that has huge implications for us with the change under the National Disability Insurance Scheme. If as the World Health Organization says, one in five people has a disability, and we're expecting that diversity in our community. We've got an enormous amount of work to change as a community to make that a possibility.
One more question, sorry. Do you think that this new scheme makes it more fun for professionals to work? And did you like measure that or collect data on that as well?
Yes. So that's why I included the quote from the support worker. I know that from this project and others that we have done, if support workers are given the autonomy and given the responsibility to have a meaningful relationship with the person they're supporting, then of course the quality of their professional life also improves. And so we're always very careful in this sort of evaluation to include the data from those workers. I'm not actually aware of a quantitative instrument on that, so if anyone knows, I would really like to use it, because we have lots of very strong qualitative research now, but not quantitative. And I think this is often put up as a barrier by service providers say, oh, you know, but all of these workers, they're going to go out there and they're not going to have any peers, and they're... which is a load of rubbish in my opinion, so I want to prove it statistically as well as prove it with the qualitative data. Thank you very much.
Okay. You're welcome. Okay.